Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and this week's show is super cool. I had the pleasure of seeing the new Troma movie, Return to Nuke 'Em High Volume 1. There is a Volume 2 forthcoming, but I saw Volume 1 this past weekend at its Chicago premiere at the Music Box Theater in Chicago, Illinois, and had the opportunity to actually sit down with the three stars of the movie, Asta Paredes, Catherine Corcoran, and Clay Von Carlowitz, and talk about what the experience is like to work on a Troma movie, their sort of interpretations of the film, and man, this was definitely like one of the coolest things I've ever been able to do, if this movie related or otherwise. I am a lifelong Troma fan, and so just to get the opportunity to see a Troma movie projected in the theater was a joy. Lloyd Kaufman was there in attendance, and I'm a huge Lloyd Kaufman fan, so that was super cool. But the movie's a blast, and having the chance to sit down with the three of them was so much fun. We recorded it actually in a Starbucks in Chicago, so there's quite a bit of background noise. I did the best I could to reduce some of it, and thank you to the fine employees at Starbucks for turning down their very loud Christmas music. They agreed to turn it down for the purposes of this podcast, such as the power of F This Movie. But we just had such a great conversation. I had such a great time talking to them. Three incredibly nice, incredibly intelligent, thoughtful people. You know, Troma sometimes gets some slack for being juvenile or crass, and it can be those things, but I defy you to listen to this conversation and tell me that the people that are making these movies are not passionate and intelligent and just really, really great people. And we had a great conversation. I really thought it was going to be like, hey, tell me some crazy stories about what it's like to work on a Troma movie and run through New York with a duck in your mouth, but instead, it was this other thing that was very much just about the nature of art and sexuality. It went all these really cool places. So even if you haven't seen the movie, which is sort of making the festival rounds right now and is actually going to be in part of an installation at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, if you haven't seen the movie, I think there's a lot to be taken away from this conversation. So I hope that you will listen anyway, because I think there's a lot to enjoy here and to appreciate, and it should, I'm hoping, make you want to see the movie. If you have the opportunity to see Return to Nuke 'Em High Volume 1, please see it. Please request it in your hometown, or Volume 2 when that comes around. I'm really hoping Volume 2 also gets to play here in Chicago and that these actors come back so I can sit down and talk with them again, because I can't wait to just hang out with them again and have more conversation like this. I really hope you enjoy it. Here goes.
I'll just record an intro after the fact, but maybe you guys want to go around and just introduce yourselves, the cast of Return to Nuke 'Em High.
Sure.
Volume 1.
Volume 1. Well, and Volume 2.
And Volume 2.
if we survive. Yeah. Yeah, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. It's
you'll have to tune in to find out.
Wait, where do they tune in, though?
I mean, we're still working out those details. So hopefully you'll stick with us. You know.
Go on the website, www.nukemhigh.com.
Return to.
Number two. Yes, number two, nukemhigh.com. Request.
Nukem. Yeah. But no, so many people do it wrong. They do like N-U-K-E-M, but it's N-U-K-E.
Apostrophe.
E-M.
Yeah, but the apostrophe before the E and the M.
Yes.
Yeah. My favorite quote dealing with Return to Nuke 'Em High as of late is, I loved growing up watching Return to Nuke 'Em High Volume 1 and The Toxic Avenger. It made me realize that time travel is possible. Because apparently hipsters are now claiming they've seen my movie.
Yes.
When they were babies.
It's always been around.
You don't know the power of hipsters.
We live in Brooklyn.
You do know the power.
You're
at Hipster Central.
Lloyd Kaufman has always professed that Troma does movies of the future, and I think that we should take that literally.
Yeah.
That being said, my name is Clay Von Carlowitz. I play Eugene in Return to Nuke 'Em High Volume 1 and 2.
Yes.
My name is Asta Paredes, and I play Chrissy Goldberg. No relation to Goldberg from the Mighty Ducks, but there is a duck in this movie. Asta Paredes.
Was that unintentional? I don't think so.
No.
No. My name is Catherine Corcoran, and I play Lauren, the new girl. Yes, that is her last name in Return to New Girl.
The hell is her last
name? I don't think I realized that.
Just Lauren, the new girl, which I think is I think is appropriate. I think that if I moved to a new town, I would change my last name to the new girl as well.
I'm pretty sure that Lauren initially had like a father character.
She did.
Wanted to drop you off at school.
But it was a chauffeur, because then it was like, why is that guy?
Because I don't think we ever cast him, so we had an actor person do something. I don't know. For whatever reason, it didn't work. But I got to pull up in this beautiful car, and that's
and you have this gigantic mansion that you lived in.
Yeah.
We never saw
my parents.
We don't really see parents much.
No, in teen movies, you never see the parents. Because then otherwise stuff doesn't happen. Because then the parent will be like, no, you can't go save the world, Chrissy. You have to stay home and do your homework.
Exactly.
Like, come on.
But I always appreciated in slashers when they at least threw you a bone, like, oh, I'm going out of town for the weekend.
Yeah.
I don't think our movie goes that far, but maybe that's what makes it special.
Like Charlie Brown. If the adults did come in, all you would hear is, wah, wah.
Yeah, and when you're in high school, you really see the world through your eyes. You don't care about the adults are the kids in your world. Yeah, they're the idiots.
So I think that it's only fitting. And the adults in this film are kind of the idiots. The adults that we do show. Not necessarily parents, but...
Yeah.
Authority figures portrayed, like,
and if they are portrayed, they're buffoons,
right? Yes. Exactly, yeah, all of them.
Which
are
I
kind
think
of
it's very much how you see things as a teenager, you're in that phase where you're questioning authority, and you very well should be, because just because somebody is older than you doesn't necessarily make them wiser,
right?
You know, and I think that it has this kind of transcendent message, because it is up to the youth to kind of shape the way our world is going to be going forward, just like it is.
What I like about the movie is that the main cast of characters sit at the loser's table. and you know, because they're somehow outcast, because they don't really maybe fall in line the same way with other people, they haven't subscribed to a certain group. For some reason, they're still on the fringe. And they're considered losers, and they happen to eat lunch out of brown bags, meaning that they don't just eat what's thrown at them. Maybe they think for themselves, and at that, you know, at the expense of being considered a loser or a pariah. But, I mean, maybe that's what Lloyd has felt like, you know?
Sure.
But he identifies with the so-called losers, because, you know, like...
Troma is the studio at the brown bag table.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I also, what I like about that, too, is that that's sort of what ends up saving everybody's lives.
Yes.
At least for a little while, but you guys aren't the ones who eat the tacos.
Well, but
Taco
we do,
Tuesday.
Chrissy and Lauren do get infected.
Right.
But that's another thing that I noticed in this film, that the goo or the contamination factor is much like the super soldier serum. It affects people in an enhancement of whatever is deep-seated inside of themselves at the moment of having it. And I think, like, it enhances for our characters, like, a sexuality and a need for vengeance, for injustice.
Right.
And I think for, you know, the bullies, the Cretans, they become infected, and it causes all this stuff that they've been, like, pushing down. And then everyone else, like, is in the frenzy of being the same, and wanting to be part of that new thing that's like the same, because you know, so I think, I mean, and we explore some of that in Volume 2, but like, it's the super soldier serum, it's that thing that makes that deep seated come out, and like, because it's a satire, we get to you know have 3-foot penises.
It's very much like I think
without surgery,
I think it's very much this beautiful kind of satire on society and how it kind of, and high school and how it kind of makes you conform a little bit, and on bullying and like what that does to people, what that does to society when you're ostracized for being different.
Right.
You know, in our film, the tormented kids, the glee club who are made fun of, become the tormentors when they mutate, and it's because, you know, they don't know what else to do, much like you see, we make jokes about it in the film, but much like you see on television and stuff, these kids who are just don't fit in and are bullied and are ostracized, that break and become these almost monstrous versions of themselves who are capable of committing these like heinous crimes. And and eventually, not to give too much away, but I think hopefully you'll see in Volume 2, that really comes full circle. and there's a really big character arc. I think that is even even more powerful as you see that for you.
Yeah,
you know?
But they actually try to, because the reason I find interesting about them is, like, they are not too dissimilar from our brown bag table, but I think the difference is that they haven't wanted to accept that they're outcast. Right. They want to still wave their free flag and be, you know, the Trauma Hoofs, but they still want to believe that, like, they have a chance. And we know, like, we pretty much don't have a chance, but we're like, whatever, yeah. Like, folks society.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very much like the X-Men, isn't it? How you have people who have been deemed freaks and then they band together.
Yeah.
And there are people who decide, you know what, I know I'm better than these people, and I'm going to punish them because they have hurt me, and like I'm just going to push that message on the world, and I'm justified. It's like a lifelong revenge cycle.
Right.
Then there's the other half of the people who recognize their power, but then think, you know, maybe I could be more responsible
with it.
Maybe I can use it for good. There's this great slasher film. I can't remember the name, but basically it was about how there's this clique in high school, and how they end up playing a trick on somebody, and then like he gets hurt, like permanently disfigured, and then he decides to go carry out revenge on everybody.
Right.
And then what happens is he ends up killing all of the bullies in the school, but then what happens is all the nerds become the new bullies of the school.
Is this the one where the actor like kills himself?
No, that's another slasher. But the point is that there's always going to be some sort of bitter group at the top who wants to just create a fascist regime so that they can just torture people because they think that they've hurt them in some way.
Right.
And it doesn't really matter like what you look like. You know, it's like a, I guess it's about how you handle things when you know better. You know?
Right.
I think we can all relate to like being bullied and picked on in high school, and always in that awkward stage where you feel like you don't fit in, and you know you don't really know what you're doing, and you, especially as actors and artists, you know, you question the path that you take is so atypical to what society does and what everyone around you is doing. And my hope is that, you know, people will watch this, and just like when they appeal with other superhero films, you know, is that you watch these characters mutate into something bigger and better than themselves, and you realize that you are capable of figuring it out, as our characters do. But there is this light at the end of the tunnel, much like Trauma is, I think, for a lot of artists and filmmakers, where it really takes a chance on his artist and kind of gives us free rein to experiment and play. And because he exists, that we have, you know, the Trey Parkers and Matt Stones and James Gunns and really innovative filmmakers, you know, who are making a difference and providing a marketplace for other artists to come up.
So when you guys all auditioned for the movie, and you had mentioned last night at the screening that there was like 9 different callbacks and just a very sort of brutal audition process. When you were auditioning, was it as like, I'm an actor looking for, here's a job that I'm right for, or was it, oh my gosh, there's a new Trauma movie, I want to be a part of that?
For me, it was literally, I mean, I've mentioned it before, I had made a list of things I wanted to do with my acting career. Law of Attraction, I guess. You just put out into the universe, and I said out loud to myself, like, I had been doing a lot of improv classes at UCB, and I felt like really free, and I was doing things with collaborations for sketch comedy, and I said, you know what, I've always really wanted to do is, I've always wanted to be in a B-movie style cult film, and not even like making fun of the genre, but saying like, this is something that I like to watch. I mean, one of my favorite films ever is Hard to Kill, starring Steven Seagal, and I mean, I think it's one of the best films you're ever going to see. I'm going to take this to the bank. The blood bank is one of the best lines. So many times I tried to fit that into the movie and see if anything would happen, but anyway, so when that happened, I made that list, and then I went on, made a subscription to casting networks after like being on a hiatus for a little bit, and then there was a listing, and it just said the simplest thing. Like, if you go on casting networks, it says things like, Audrey's had a rough life. She rediscovered herself.
It's like a 3-paragraph explanation.
She has a friend, but then at the end of it, it's like, must be willing to show deep integrity in the role and blah, 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 blah. And this said, Chrissy, attractive, not so innocent. Some nudity required. And I thought, you know what? Like, for some reason, and then the title was Return to Mika High, and I vaguely, like, thought it might have been related to Class of Mika High, but it wasn't, like, an official, like, trauma entertainment.
Right.
But then when I Googled and stuff, I saw so many things, and I just thought, you know what? Like, sometimes as an actor, you need to take, like, a huge leap from something different than what's not working, because insanity is doing the same thing, expecting new results.
Right.
So I expected something was going to happen, and I didn't know what, and I went in, and, you know, I told the story of the first time I did acid, and I was like, if this is an audition, then, and then every time I went in, it was like, I'm just a person, because, I mean, for all of us in different ways, but I know for me, and a bit for Katie, we are playing satirizations of ourselves in this film, which is why it's so, why it's so easy.
Uh-huh.
I grew up in Texas. I grew up in a high school full of prejudice. I was closeted as well, to the point where my high school boyfriends and such still have no idea that I had a very serious relationship with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was like a personal piece for me.
Right,
so
right.
As that became progressive, I mean, that's how I found it. So I just saw it as a moment to do a film that was going to be exciting and inciting and wake up something.
It's interesting that you talk about that autobiographical aspect to the characterization, because
you are Eugene.
I don't want to. I won't say that. I got a notice from Backstage, another submission website, and it said it was looking for a character. They were looking for like four lead characters, and one of them was named Brick. And they said he's like some kind of a tough guy. And I was thinking there was another character. They were like a nerdy character, like named Eugene.
Okay.
And I thought, you know what? Like, I know the way people see me. I know I'm going to have to audition for the tough guy, because that's all the way that people will just think, like, yeah, he's like a little bit muscular, whatever. He's only going to play like a brute or like a dumb jock. And
right.
So I went in to audition for Brick. So like Asa said, like, you tell a story or a joke or something. I told the plot of a slasher I was writing in the first person, and I never told them it was like a joke. I told them that like I was seriously plotting to murder all my friends and pin it on a professor, and they just like they really were put off by me. I mean, I didn't think I was going to be called back, but 3 weeks later I was, and then I was one of the Cretans for like for like a whole day, and I got to audition with them, and I got to play the lead Cretan, Leonardo, and I tried really hard to be this like tough guy leader, and it reminded me of when I was in high school and how, you know, like I played football like grade school, high school, and then even into college, because like I had ADD and my mom wanted me to be organized in some way. So I really tried to like be like my older brother and be like tough, but I just couldn't sell it to people. It was like they, nobody would buy it, and it's like, and I just was like frustrating to me, and like, but I like put all my heart and soul into it. But then they just had me read for this nerdy character, and then the next audition I came in, it was Eugene, who, like the name of the nerdy character, he had fused with this like apparent alpha male jockish.
Yeah, which happened because apparently I was too attractive to play just a dykish. Lesbian.
Yeah, I think they went back and we auditioned for each other's parts. I think that was part of it. I remember us having this conversation, like, what are they going to see? What are they going to cast us as? Because this is supposed to be a really dykey character. Neither of us are very dykey. But
I made a case for it. But then that's how he came.
Yeah,
in.
Yeah, and so like luckily they wrote this scene like where like Eugene is really trying to have sex with his girlfriend Chrissy, and like it doesn't work out, and like I was told to just, you know, feel free to improvise, and
yeah, we changed the script entirely.
Yeah, and so yeah, we took that literally, and I just like did like, I don't know, because like I grew up in Ohio, and I grew up in like where people are really kind of conservative, and I'm not saying they're like not sexual or whatever, but it's like only to a point, like they're kind of embarrassed about it or something like
right.
that. And I was like sort of thinking like, this is me like not thinking I'm enough or whatever. And, you know, like really trying hard to be what I think the girl wants, and, or more in a broader sense, trying to be what I think people want to see. Like, how do I make friends, or how do I get people to like me? And, like, I, you know, it's, you, I have memories of being humiliated and being called like an idiot and stuff, and like, you know, being the butt of jokes and like seeing this like this fool. And I guess it's at like I said, like being a loser, you know, you try to give an honest crack at being a human being.
Right.
And then maybe you end up falling on your ass. But the point is, like, you keep trying,
yeah.
You know? And, like, yeah, maybe Eugene's, like, sort of looks like or falls into a jock stereotype. But I never really saw him as just that. I guess I saw him as, like, somebody who, like tried to perfect a type, you know? But, like, when that, like, failed, he just, like... You know, you just feel like figure like, what do I do? Yeah. What do I do? To
it's
be
it's like Screech and Zach's love child, yeah. Because he looks. Because I mean, I remember early Saved by the Bell, like Zach was unpopular, and you're like, why is he unpopular? Yeah. Look at this guy. But I mean, and it's the same thing. But then, like, you know, you have Eugene, and I mean, what's funny is like I was just thinking when you were talking about the scene, like I had 4 or 5 guys audition to play that role right before that. And it got to the point where Lloyd asked me if I was okay and everything.
Yeah.
And I was like, the next guy that walks in that room cannot even, like, touch me. Like, I don't want to be touched at all. Because we were simulating a makeup scene.
Sure.
So then he comes in and he, like, just was like, well, I'm just going to pretend I'm touching you. And, like, goes full on. And it became this thing of, like, the scene had to be, like, we improvised the lines and changed it. The scene had to basically be autobiographical in the sense of, what can I say to tell this guy to not have sex with
right,
me? So
right.
I was like, I'm having a
all sorts of things.
And it was, like, really awkward.
I think Nukem High kind of came into my life at, like, really... I guess I couldn't have asked for a more perfect time because I moved to New York very young, by myself, and it was kind of the only thing that I had ever really focused on was my acting career and, like, my art. That was the only thing I ever really threw myself into. And I was getting to this point in the collegiate academia world where, you know, when you're trying so hard to be the best at something and you're just kind of continuously, like, beaten down, and they're trying to make you better, you know, but you get to this point where you're just like, God, what am I doing, you know?
Right.
And I had been booking, like, small parts, but, you know, nothing that was really satisfying, that, like, hunger to really develop something. And I saw the casting on the Casting Networks for Nukem High, and I, like, I remember thinking, they are not going to cast me. I did research on, you know, on it, and found Troma, and I knew a little bit about the company, not too much, you know, and I thought that it was really cool. I was really excited, but I was like, no way. There's no way. They're going to look at me and go, this little girl, like, no. And they took a chance on me, I guess, and really, you know, let me kind of run wild a little bit. And I had never worked on a project where I had that much creative freedom,
yeah.
And was able to really develop this girl and play with her insecurities and play with her trying to just be comfortable in her own skin, which is very much something, you know, I was going through at the time. And I mean, I was surrounded by this group of people who were so supportive of that, that it kind of, I think, it really shaped who I am now and who I'm becoming as an artist, I think, because I have this new confidence in what I do, and I take these risks, and, you know, I'm not so worried about if it's right or wrong.
Right.
I'm more excited about the process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I couldn't have asked for, you know, better people to do that with, and also the results that we've gotten from it. You know, I remember the collegiate community being very critical of me doing this film, this
sure.
movie, being, you know, like, this is not Shakespeare, this is not art, this is not... And here we are, a year later, in MoMA's Contender Series with some of the greatest filmmakers in the world.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's just... I think it really goes to show what you can accomplish when you put your heart in something, when you do take on projects that you truly are passionate about.
Yeah. And then once you do that, you realize that's the only way.
Yeah, I mean, I can never go back at this point. I've tried to do, like, little things again, you know, I've gone through different management where they've been like, oh, let's put you, because I did Gossip Girl for a little bit, they're like, let's put you back in that genre, let's
right.
get you there. And I'm just kind of, I don't enjoy it as much.
Yeah.
And not because certain, like, projects like that aren't great, just because
right.
for me it's not a challenge, it's not exciting.
Right.
And I'm lucky enough that this has spurred other you know, cool artistic projects, and I've gotten to work with some great filmmakers since. So
yeah.
I hope it just continues that way.
I don't know. I feel a pressure from it because, you know, given, like she's saying, the results of the movie and, like, they have me accepted. I'm going to be honest with you. When I made the movie, from my portion of it, my acting and everything, I was completely not planning on it to be an idealistic revolution. It was just like, you know, young actors, young filmmakers getting together, making a movie, hanging out. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I was falling in love in the middle of the production, and I just was having a summer away from the city, and was able to, like, find myself. That's never going to happen again.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
I can say to you now, like, oh, I can't wait to do another idealistic project, but it'll never, the ingredients happened. It already was made, you know, from this point out, like, I will probably take from it, like, that the best things in life happen when you're not wanting them to happen. And you're not expecting them to happen, or you're expecting to find anything. You just do it because you just feel like doing it, not putting any labels on it or any hopes on it. You're just like, you know what, I'm just going to do this. I would wake up every morning, take a shower. I had my Chrissy routine. I'd braid one single braid because it's a Padawan braid. And, you know, and she's an orphan. And if you put that together, you know that this is Star Wars. I would do that. I would go walk around. I'd have coffee. I'd desperately flirt. And
if you haven't picked up on it, she's with me.
Yeah, and
put the claim down right now, so I can't swoop in. Quite.
Yeah,
jeez.
But and then I would go. Yeah, this is true. And I would go, like, for a run or a walk or whatever. And that's never gonna happen again. If, like, say my career goes really well, like, and I get tons of money, like. Doing
still
whatever,
never gonna,
it's never going to happen.
Right.
Like, it's going to have to be, like, you know, I do well just so that I do well. And then, like, suddenly, like, I need to, like, prove myself and do Return to Nuka Pie Volume 3.
Well, that's the thing that's always so singular, I think, about trauma movies, and the reason that they have such a hardcore fan base is because everybody senses how special they are and, like, oh, this thing shouldn't exist, and somehow it does.
Yeah.
And that's a cool thing. And it's just hearing you guys talk about all your processes, that's one of the things that I'm kind of a lifelong fan since I saw, I think, The Toxic Avenger as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I've always been shouting, like, no, this is art. This is art. And people write it off. One of the things that I've always really liked about specifically the movies that Lloyd directs and probably the more recent ones is that there's all this craziness going on. There's people with ducks in their mouths and mutants melting and just lots of violence and all this craziness. But at the center of it is always human beings. And I really like how all of your performances aren't necessarily, like, winking at the camera, like, oh, we know this is silly and we're in on the joke and ha ha ha. Even if you are in on the joke, like, basically playing it
straight.
And I think that's so cool. Like, I think it's so cool hearing about how much you informed Eugene with, because he could just seem kind of like this cartoon character.
Yeah,
like,
and has been described as
who's kind of overcompensating. But I love hearing that, like, this thought process of, like, this is a guy faking his way through life.
Yeah. I mean, it could be just people's perception of the character, because, you know, this is trauma, and it's seen through, in a way, it's seen through Lloyd's eyes. And so it's framed in a certain way. And, like, yeah, certain characters, like, there's a need for comic relief, I suppose. And so, yeah, like, I guess people could just think, it's like, I don't know, I feel like it's like me in, like, high school and college. Like, that guy's an idiot.
Yeah, you see that, like, with all the characters, because, and that is what it is to be young and learning. It's like, you're trying so hard to fit what you think you're supposed to be, and that's part of the genius of Lloyd and his films, is that, you know, it's not sex and gore for the sake of sex and gore. He very much strategically places it and wants to have a social commentary, is saying something with this, you know, and is saying something about the human condition, and that's what makes it art, and that's what makes real artists attractive to his work.
Yeah.
It's also saying that life is, like, you never grow out of high school.
Uh-huh. Oh, no,
it stays with you. You know, I mean, like, I had a friend come see the movie, and like she kept saying like how that's like someone I know.
Yeah.
And they're not in high school.
Yeah, right.
In so many words. I mean, right. People are what they are. They're petty, or they power is siphoned. You are who you are in high school forever. And if that means you were the prom queen, in your mind, you still believe that you hold that power, I guess, but you don't.
Right.
Because you didn't earn it right. Then. You're not earning it now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I had a very weird experience because I grew up in Texas and, like I said, and I literally hung out with every major group. I was a jock. I did cross country. I was in the drama club. I was even a cheerleader for a brief period of time. I was a punk girl, like a wannabe punk skater, pack specific swimwear girl. All sorts of things. And then I was somehow widely accepted as someone who, you know, just was who she was. But I still got bullied. That's the sad part about it.
Yeah.
but that's because people in Texas think that if your name is Paredes, that you have something to do with Osama bin Laden.
What I think is interesting now, because I'm the youngest of the group, so I'm not close to high school, but it's still very much a part of who
sure.
I am. You know, it's only been a few years since I graduated, and for me, the most interesting thing is... when I was in high school, how horribly bullied I was to the point where I would, like, not go to school, cut class, like, find any excuse not to go. And now the outpouring of, like, enthusiasm I've gotten from my hometown since is kind of interesting to me. People whose radar was never on growing up
right.
now suddenly want me to take them as their date to one of the screenings. And it's become this, like, it really kind of forced me to, like, reevaluate what is high school. And it's the truth. Like, nobody, you really never grow out of it. It's like just this little power shift. Oh, she's doing something cool. So now,
right.
now she's on our level. And it's...
fair weather friends.
Yeah. And it's just like, you know, either, I mean, I take this a compliment. It's very sweet. But at the same time, it makes me laugh. You know, it's funny how that happens. And it's, I guess, like you never really do grow out of high school. And it's with you.
Yeah, there's sort of this, I don't know, in high school, for me, like, yeah, it was sort of similar to what Asta was describing. I mean, like, I didn't want to be just a footballer. So I was like, I had half the year was drama friends. And then some of the football players went over and started doing plays with me. And it was like, for a brief moment in time, it felt like, we're all friends.
Yeah.
And then it disappeared.
And, but then it was like, it just ended. As soon as we graduated, that was it. Everyone went back. And then when I got to college, it was this horrible rude awakening because there were the frats and there were, like, stoners and there were people who did, like organized unions and stuff on campus and they're, like, the theater people. And it was all so segregated all over again. It was like, no, like, this is sort of reality. You have to have a category.
Right.
And then maybe you'd have some friends. Like, I was in a frat in college and, like, yeah, I had some friends who, like, would go see a play, but it was, like, sort of like they would, like, be, like, low-key about it because
right.
they can't really, like, outright say that I'm endorsing this group.
Right.
You kind of have to stay in your corner. But you have these, like, fantasies where, like, yeah, maybe we're all, you know, kind of similar, but we know that we're going to have to go back and be, you know, what, I guess what we're best at and then, like, know that that will result in
right.
attention.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I hope that this film can kind of bring people together out of their niches, but I feel like it really does have a little bit for everyone. You know, people always ask, how would you sell this film to someone who isn't a trauma fan? And I'm like, well, what do you like about movies? Do you like action movies? Do you like special effects? Do you like gore? Do you like sex? Do you like comedy? Do you like a feel-good story? Because we have it.
Right.
And so, and what is kind of funny is even my family, you know, when I first got this film, my mother was saying, you know, she's doing this film. It's the company with the guys from South Park, so it's kind of sophomoric humor. And she came to, we had a benefit to get the film to Cannes this year, which we did accomplish, and she came to the gallery auction that we did, and she was so thrilled and loved all of it, all the, like, silliness, and was so happy with it that it was kind of like this cool moment of, like, look, like, this is my mother, right, you know, who is loving this, and she brought a friend, and, like, you know, it really can kind of open you guys up to things that you don't realize is part of who you are.
Yeah, actually, that makes me think about Lloyd's and Troma's position in the industry. You know, like, this movie is perhaps more mainstream than most Troma movies in that it has such a crossover appeal, and
it's
been
also the aesthetic of it.
And the aesthetic,
it makes
it
easier for people to digest.
Exactly. Right. It was shot beautifully, and the music is great. But
we have Grammy-nominated artists on the soundtrack.
Yeah.
Tiger Lilies, which is incredible. We
really lucked out with all the talent involved. But there are people who enjoy Lloyd's movies but really don't feel comfortable saying that. And there's, like, even a lot of critics who time and time again have to give a compliment, but then they qualify it.
Right.
They have to put something in there.
But then that's something I've begun to accept, which we've talked about in kind of ins and outs, but, like, would it be wanted for Lloyd to be in the mainstream and accepted? Because it's kind of like how, you know, my point in high school when everyone separated was the election. I was the one that wore the John Kerry shirt that said, "Carry me to victory," and that was a polarizing thing.
Right, right.
And I used to joke about, wouldn't it be great if John Stewart ran for president? But his role is the satire.
Right.
His role is to do that, and if Lloyd were to be accepted, then it would defeat the whole
fucking
purpose.
Well, the thing is, Lloyd doesn't want to be. He knows that he never will.
No, right? So I don't, like, I mean, when we have these interviews and stuff, it just always occurs to me, like, I don't really want the mainstream to accept this film, but I know that they do.
Well, that's what's funny about it, though, because you can see underneath that they're, like, maybe they love it
they're
or something, but they're not going to say it out loud.
I appreciate the mainstream for coming. That's not to say that I don't appreciate them. However, I think if we weren't this underground, struggling little, I think plays called the little independent film that could, the little independent film engine that could, you know, we wouldn't... It wouldn't have been the experience that it is for all of us, and Troma wouldn't go on to be this company that provides filmmakers and artists the forum to do that.
Yeah.
And I think film industry, and I think the art world needs that.
Yeah.
You know, we need somebody to, like, see the reality of what it is to be a struggling filmmaker and take those risks.
We need 20 years to pass, and then it's going to be at midnight screenings in every city with cults, people dressing up and wearing big penises, and...
Pregnancy bellies.
Yeah,
Eugene the Machine T-shirt.
I honestly, like,
American Apparel,
as much as I want to be selfish just for my own career and everything, I'm not Chrissy. You know, like, I can fade into any other character I want to do. Like, I'm not worried about myself, but I don't need Chrissy to be the darling of every household in America for at least 20 to 25 years. Why? Because that's what every major cult film is. You know.
Right.
If my parents had taken me to see Hard to Kill when it first came out, I probably would have. But I watched it at 4 a.m., high off my ass, and I fell in love with that goddamn movie. And I want to remake it, starring myself.
Well, society, they kind of embrace art when they're ready for it.
It's antiquity. It's always, I wonder what it was like. It's such a charming little film, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to need a bigger boat was not in the script, you know?
Right.
There's a lot of things in this movie that weren't in the script.
Like,
no, none of it was in the script. There was no final script.
I always compare it to, like, the work of Salvador Dali, or even before him, even some of the work of Monet. When they started as painters, you know, everyone looked at their work and was like, what the hell is this?
Right.
This is, what do you mean this man is just kind of using these bright colors and gesturing to people shapes? And now, like, now that he's dead, which is what Lloyd seems to think will happen, everyone is like, oh, I will pay millions for this, the original copy, you know? And I think that is our role as artists, is to take these risks and pose questions and know at the end of the day that we may not ever make a penny, you know, but hopefully that we've left the world with something a little bit more beautiful.
Yeah, definitely.
You know,
how has the experience been now, sort of, on this, like, on the Troma train? Because it is such a different, it's a way of life, practically, and you guys are out promoting the movie, and how has that been?
It's required us to develop a new set of skills, at least from my point of view, is that, like, I realized that I had to be able to talk about my work and to talk about... to talk about the movie and to know the industry a little bit, and then also to know that Troma has legions of fans, because I really didn't know Troma before this movie.
Yeah.
And also, I guess, to be prepared to kind of, to get condescending looks, you know, like, that's what happened. You know, we went to Cannes, like, there's a lot of people who responded to it, but then, you know, there's some people, you know, who are clearly, like, a little bit, like, put off by sort of the freak show aspect of Troma, you know, and, but that's, like Asta was saying, that's sort of, that's uniquely Troma, though.
I want
though,
it to be that way. Yeah. I mean, Katie and I spend a lot of time in Cannes rubbing elbows with very important executives and producers, you know, I'm not going to name, but they start with a W. And we, one of the things that I kind of enjoyed about, or find amusing, and I find it amusing as a female because I, not in like any sort of offensive way, but I've always considered myself like non-gender. Like I embrace having a womanly figure and everything, but like I grew up having an immigrant family and my mother not wanting me to feel pigeonholed by a marriage, a man or anything. So having said that, like, I find it amusing how suddenly I show my tits on screen and I'm like, people like try to act like that's not what happened, but that's why they're interested in me.
Okay.
You know, like, oh, here you're in a Troma film. And behind that is like, here you allowed someone to take off your clothes.
What's interesting.
And you you went to, you know, what else do you do? Like, and they're suddenly intrigued.
Yeah.
And, and as females, it's so interesting to me how the industry, like, just instantly, I guess, I don't know if it's hypocritical or what, but just suddenly it's like, they talk to you differently when they know you've done nudity.
Mm-hmm.
But then when they've seen us do the nudity, they realize, like, wow, these girls are not damsels. They actually own their sexuality. And I don't really feel uncomfortable watching it so much as, like, this is kind of good.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's, but it is funny. We've gotten solicited by many filmmakers for a lot of not so savory things.
Yeah, the nudity for me has become, and even recently, I go in these phases where I'm kind of afraid of it again, but it's this empowering thing at this point, you know, where it's like, I like the artistic statement that it makes. I like questioning why people are uncomfortable with the female form. You know, I like the way that the body is censored in mainstream media, female-wise and male-wise, it's completely unequal. What you can show, what you can't show. And I also, I've gotten to this point where I like posing questions and making people think all the time. People come up to us and in the interviews will say, the girls are surprisingly quite intelligent.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
we've had so many interviews where they come
surprisingly
up
quite intelligent. And I always go,
they're,
you know,
very well spoken.
I know. And I always say, and I always, whenever they say that, now, at first I didn't know how to react to it, but now it's always like, oh, well, why are you surprised?
Right.
And then they're like,
I amusingly like pretending to be dumb sometimes. Like, I've gone to, we've been, you know, traveling with this movie several different places or having interviews at conventions or whatever. And sometimes, you know, like, Lloyd is very famous for, you can't ever see it on a podcast, but, like, he does this.
He holds his hands up, presenting sort of gesture.
And I started realizing after a while, like, I'd have people, like, talk to me and be like, how's it working on the movie? And like, they're, you know, and I'll say, like, it was great. It was fantastic. And I mean, my mom used to be a flight attendant, so I've like inherited that ability. But yeah, I'll like be like, yeah, I love it. And last night when people came to see the movie, like, I was going around high-fiving him, like, you're about to see me naked on screen, high five. Like, I embrace it, make fun of it, like, I just own it. Like, I love Raquel Welch, I love, like, all these pinups. Marilyn knew what she was doing, I know what I'm doing, and I like fucking with people. So.
Yeah, I've learned to look around during the sexy makeout stance when, you know, whenever
everyone... Please, say woo, I don't care.
Yeah, so when they think things are going to happen, like, I like to look around and watch everybody kind of get a little uncomfortable, but kind of enjoying themselves, and also kind of... It's just, it's become this weird social experiment for me, and I'm loving it, and it brings me, again, I guess, back to high school, where I used to do paintings and try to throw in as many naked bodies and phallic symbols as I possibly could, just because I knew it would be in the hallway, and I loved how uncomfortable it made everybody. And, you know, it's just like, it's this weird thing about our society and about how we view things, and it's fun, and I think it's kind of the new the new, not, I don't want to say frontier, but it's definitely a new obstacle that we're kind of overcoming in the art world with the acceptance of the female form and appreciating that.
Well, it's,
a little bit.
It's post-feminism, post-feminism.
Yeah.
Because we got girls like Miley Cyrus, but I was actually saying I love the hell out of her, and I know it's probably planned image, whatever,
yeah.
I don't give a fuck because she's still using it, but pornography has spilled into the mainstream.
Right.
But the difference is that, like, some women know what that means and some women don't know what it means. They're just like, all right, I'm going to wear my spanky shorts and I'm going to go outside and I'm going to do this. But then for, like, us, like, I have been wearing crop tops ever since and I wear bustiers and all of that kind of stuff and I'm completely comfortable with my body. But I carry myself while reading, you know, Ivanov. Like,
right.
Yeah.
It's...
Well, what's
it's
funny is that there's
being
been,
yourself.
Like you said, there's been a lot of people who've approached you and Katie, like, trying to get you to, like, to do parts that, like you said, were unsavory because they assume, like, oh, you showed, you know, you showed your, you showed off your naked body on
Listen,
screen.
Listen, I mean, this part's great. Like, she's got a great character arc. Like, and, you know, like, 15 minutes, you just have to have your tits out. But, like,
yeah. Hop on number four. Let me tell you about her.
Yeah.
You know, but I think, and so, like, that's the thing is, like, we do know the difference between artistic nudity and gratuitous nudity.
Right.
Yeah, and
it's knowing who you are.
Yeah,
that's
it's knowing when it's when it makes sense and when it's stupid,
right.
You know, and
right.
when it's provocative and poses questions and when it doesn't.
I mean, I wish we could be like Monty Python and just get naked for no reason and be funny.
You know?
I've never seen it be funny for a woman to be naked.
Yeah,
just,
that's really exciting.
I was just
going to
say that. This movie, watching it last night, I was thinking about it. I know you guys had said, I haven't seen Volume 2 yet, but I know you had said there's a lot of male frontal nudity.
Well, there's
in
also a lot
two.
Of female
nudity.
Sure.
Yeah.
But that's one of the interesting things to me is that so often female nudity is sexy, male nudity is funny, and those are the categories that we only see men naked in comedic situations.
Uh-huh.
But
or
rarely
even if it's not comedic,
see.
It somehow becomes comedic.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Because it's, what's the word, like, women, men, and this probably has to do with, like, my sexuality, whatever it is, but, like, men are typically seen as equipment.
Sure.
And women are seen as, because evolutionarily speaking, there's no reason for us to have the body that we have except for to appeal to the male and the seed. It's the only species in which that's the case. The male normally has to look a certain way in order to attract the female, who is normally the plainer of the two. So it's interesting because we have the curve saying code, sending code to men saying, like, all right, she's pretty smart. She can carry the child. It won't hurt her. She might live to help me bear it. Like, she's also, like, this and this and this. She eats well. Like, it's... But men, it's like... He can shoot it out.
Yeah. And there's so little known about the female sexuality and pleasure centers and things. That's still kind of this unknown thing in a world where we have the scientific ability to clone sheep, yet we cannot figure out, you know, what pleases a woman. And it's just
because it's not okay to talk about.
Exactly.
It we still
yeah. And it's just this, like, really interesting. You know, I don't know. Thing and I think Joss was talking about, you know, funny female nudity. I think we have a little funny. Yeah, I think so too. And I think a little bit at towards the end, and hopefully people think, not to give too much away, but we screened the first 5 minutes of Volume 2 at the New York Horror Film Festival, and I liked that people, that is a lot of nudity in it, female nudity, and I liked that people were laughing and also kind of grossed out at the same time. And the beginning of, like, the first scene is at the end of Volume 1 where my character is in the shower,
right.
And at first the, like, with the period, not
right.
to give too much away, in the goop.
Yeah. Well,
and,
it's
and,
yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, but he's borrowing from Brian De Palma,
right.
Who's known for his
sweets.
Yeah,
right.
And I
right.
really like, at first, everyone's like, yeah, and then they're like, ugh, and then people are kind of, like, laughing at the same time, and
yeah.
I love that. I think it's one of my favorite things, because it's so funny. Everyone's like, yeah, it's going to be really hot, and then it just hit, and I think it's hilarious.
Actually,
I love it.
I take it back. There has been one funny female nudity of recent that I love, and you'd have to look it up online, but it's Chelsea
Kathy
Handler.
Bates,
no, Chelsea Handler and Sandra Bullock.
I
they did,
that, yeah.
Yeah, that was hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was just because it's a lot about how they handle themselves, and they're both, like, two of my favorite people.
Yeah.
But they both are, like, they both curse like sailors, and, like, it's just so awesome. They have that locker room scene, and they're
right.
like, get into shape. And I mean, yeah, the female form is confusing, but I think the other thing about the female form that is, like you were talking about, it really isn't that they don't know or we don't know how to please ourselves. It's that women require time and men require place.
Watching the movie last night, one of the things that I like about specifically this movie was that some of the nudity is played for laughs, some of it is sort of making a political statement, but I think the reason, one of the reasons I like Trauma is that it's willing to say it's okay to like this.
Yeah.
And possibly my favorite scene in the movie, and you guys aren't naked in the scene, but the party scene where the band is playing, and I don't remember the song, but it's like, I'm going to kill myself tonight.
Yeah, Rape Door. It's the last, it's called The Last Song.
Okay. And it's where you guys really kind of click. Mm-hmm. And it was so great to watch, because I wasn't even watching it from a perspective of like, oh, this is titillating, two girls are maybe going to kiss. It reminded me of, did you guys ever see Monster, Charlize Theron?
Yes.
Christina. There's a scene early, where they roller skate and this Journey song is playing, and it's right where they maybe start to fall in love. And it reminded me so much of that scene, because it's like you're watching something, not to use this word that's stupid, especially in this context, but like flower, that you're seeing this happen right in front of you.
Yeah, and we wanted to justify that moment.
Yeah.
And
I thought that was such a great scene.
And when we were rehearsing it, there was so much anxiety about it with the two of us. We weren't sure how to do it, and we just kind of went for it. And it was this moment of insecurity, because we were only, like, what, our first or second day of shooting?
It was the second day, and we originally had awkwardly choreographed, because there was no real scripting on it, but the brief scripting on it was something to the effect of, like, cut shot of, like, them awkwardly dancing, then getting more drinks, then awkwardly dance, then suddenly them getting so close that they forget that everyone else is there. And Justin Duvall, the director of photography, came up and said, I've got this great idea. We're going to get you guys wet, just get in the shower, and we're just going to do, like, a music video type thing, shoot it in one shot. And Katie and I kind of looked at each other, then we looked at Lloyd, kind of like, Lloyd, you're the director. What do you have to say about this? And we both, like, were like, you know,
let's go.
So we went in the shower, came out, and we were on this, like, adrenaline high. And like I said, I was also falling deeply in love during the production of the movie, and, like, this excitement, and I was kind of hoping you were watching. And and so I had this, like, feeling of, like, wild abandon. And in what's great about it is that the context of a movie translates that to look at Christy and Lauren fall in love. For the actresses, we weren't really acting. We were just more like, look, this is just a fucking awesome time.
Yeah,
like,
and I think we relied on each other so much throughout the production, because it was scary and it was new.
Sure.
You know, we didn't know what we were getting ourselves into. We still kind of rely on each other. The other day I was nervous about a promo shoot we're doing. I'm on the phone with Asta before I go to bed. Like, you know, and like, I think you can see that in that scene as well. It's this, like, this just coming together and kind of knowing that we're in this together, and let's just go for it.
And like, there's a bunch of guys staring at us off screen, and we're just like, you know what?
Let's do it.
Dancing.
And I remember, and this is my favorite moments of the production is, you know, we're doing the scene and we finish it, and there's this person who worked on the set, Stuart, who is this amazing man. He's a sweetheart. You see him. He's the party scene. He's the water slide.
Oh, that was his birthday. That day on set was his birthday.
Yeah. And we walk up. We're down the stairs. We go over to him. And he's like tearing up, and we're like, "Well, what's wrong? Like, what's going on?" And he says, "And God, it's like I'm beaming. You can't even see it on this interview, but he says people who watch this movie and they're gonna be struggling with their sexuality, and they're gonna know what love is in this moment. They're going to figure it out and get it." And it was just such a, like, it was just such a grounding moment. Like, wow. Like, that was, I think, the first moment I really had this, like, feeling like this production was bigger than us. You know?
Yeah. We weren't trying to tell a lesbian love story. We were trying to tell a story. Like, that's the other thing. Like, every time we get a review that, like, qualifies my character, for instance, as lesbian, I'm like, I don't really know that. I just think she's, like, a really horny teenager.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, she wasn't finding anything with Eugene. And maybe she did at some point, you know? We actually explore that in a viral series that we did as a prequel. But she clicks with someone that, like, is her Darcy,
right,
who challenges her and tells her she's an idiot and that she's, you know, and like suddenly like forgets that for a moment, and then they find that bridge.
Yeah, we didn't go into this
trying to tell a lesbian love story.
Yeah, trying to make this like this archetypal
or
lesbian.
Like I'll be the man if you be the woman.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
It's like,
it was very much just two people falling in love in the circumstances, and it and I think that's what one of the things I'm most proud of. Is that it really is just this honest story.
And the thing is, it isn't like every other trauma movie. Because if you think about the original Class of Nukem High, there was a central romance, but it was almost sort of like this joke. Like, okay, so it's
a jock and a
cheerleader.
They're the square kids.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's just like, I've seen this before 1,000 times. But this time, I don't know what happened between like Lloyd and the screenwriters and, well, the actors who were cast in the parts, but it was like he dared to let a real love story happen on screen without it even being like commenting on itself. Right. And it was
It really wasn't supposed to be like the focus before either. It was almost like another social, not gimmick, but it was like another thing. Like, all right, so now the modern version is going to have two lesbians. And blah, 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 blah. But this one, whatever. And because we were both so like down for making this an actual love story, because it's difficult to construct a love story in a teenage movie too, because it's like, well, they really like each other, and maybe before the summer ends, like, you know,
we'll get it in.
Let's see. But like for us, I mean, when you see Volume 2, you'll see like, wow, this got really serious.
Yeah.
But that dancing, I think it's kind of crucial, and that's why there was no scripting for it, and it was one take. That was one take.
And it kind of
feel that.
Yeah.
But I think we felt and it seems that reviewers and audiences have felt it kind of grounds the film a little bit, like amidst all this craziness, there is this underlying story. I remember doing our sex scene, and the former New York Film Commissioner, Pat Kaufman, whose wife was there, and I remember she said, like, post that, some of the first few times I met her, she's like, oh, it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. And she was genuinely telling us that it looked beautiful. And, you know, it was our first sex scene. It was like really new territory, and I don't think I realized what this film veteran was saying. It was like, no, this is actually really beautiful amidst the silliness. You know?
Because because we had no idea what a sex scene was supposed to be.
Yeah,
really.
We just tried to make it as authentic as we possibly could. And what I also like is in the authenticity, you watch it and you're like, wow, this is like really a sex scene.
Yeah.
Really like sex. And then all of a sudden there's like green goo, which was delicious.
Yes.
which was delicious, and like feathers, and I like that. It's very much like the shower scene where it's like, this is gonna be really hot.
Right.
Wait a minute.
Right.
You know, and I like that. I think it's fun.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, that's what it should be.
Yeah.
And now, not to spoil anything in Volume 2, but obviously Eugene has some major things happen to him at that party as well.
God.
Does that continue?
No.
Okay, so all right. So let me explain to you what happened with Eugene.
Okay.
So it started out as really like this two-scene character, and then Lloyd realized that I was doing something with the character, and he humored me, and he let me go with it. And then I would I would get lines sent back to me from Travis Campbell, who was at the trauma office back in New York City, and while we were filming Niagara Falls, and it was in response to what I was doing with the character, and I guess they were thinking, what would happen if we threw this at the character?
Right.
What would he do?
Right.
And then I would take it and I would go with it, and then, I mean, the thing is that
Eugene
like,
has a line in this scene, and, and Clay's like, what?
Eugene
should be in this scene, right? He's not on the call sheet, but he should be here.
The thing is, I think that Lloyd kind of, I don't know, he liked the idea of having a fool around, and also just like wondering, okay, so, you know, what if things don't work out the way that the guy would want them to or expect them to?
Right.
And then when he comes up with an idea like that, he thinks like, okay, well, what if, like, you know, what if something can be mined from these new things that he's discovered? And to answer your question, yes, he goes much further with that. It's interesting having to work with developments like that that weren't really planted from the beginning, but
and knowing what like knowing what, like, the other suggestions and possibilities to your storyline were.
Yeah, there's a million different ways, like, I guess it could have gone, but I guess that's,
like... No, but, like, the options that, like, fell through and, like... You were supposed to hook up with two girls at that party.
Yeah.
Originally.
Yeah, originally they were going to have two girls. I was going to be with two girls at this party, and then I was, you know.
You weren't going to be in any other scenes after
yeah.
that.
Yeah, yeah. And that was just going to be written out of the movie, basically. But then they wanted to keep me around, and then I guess, yeah, they thought of, like, well, what if we introduce a dick into the into the fray?
Well, I mean, it's like you know, he says... He's, you know, when you talk about, like, my character, Chrissy, saying, like, oh, I like you in your butch kind of way, that assertive kind of way. But for him, he's not even meaning that in a metaphor. He's like, I kind of like it when you remind me of a kind of a man.
Sure.
But I don't know what to do with what you've got.
Yeah, exactly.
And clearly you're not feeling it either. So it's almost perfect that he, like, kind of yeah. finds someone who's, like, got both things,
right,
and he's like,
right.
I'm confused
yeah.
that this, I never thought of this before.
And have that be, you know, read into that as much as you want. If you want to look at that as sort of a metaphor.
It's not
what,
a metaphor.
Like, okay, say whatever you want. But, anyway, yeah, he, I guess it's like, yeah, like you said about your character, Asta, you know, he's a horny teenager, and doesn't really know himself as much as he'd like to think he does. And I mean, fuck it. Like, when life happens to you, like, sometimes, you know, you got to go with it. And,
yeah,
you know, just consider out. Like, why not? It's like at the
yeah.
end of Some Like It Hot. You
right.
know, nobody's perfect, right?
right.
But meaning, like, you know, just take a walk on the wild side. Maybe
yeah.
Find yourself. Find yourself. He's going through a sexual experimentation the same way the girls are, you know, this
right.
trying to understand
right.
what makes
yeah.
him tick.
And you know what? If you want to think of him as a freak in that sense, that's okay. You know, like, oh, I don't really swing that way, whatever. At least he dares to, you know, give it a try, you
yeah.
know?
Well, that's what I liked about it, because, again, going back to this idea of, like, when you two are experimenting, it's hot.
Yeah.
And then when it happens to him, it becomes funny. It's like, haha, she has a dick, and isn't this funny? Because
yeah.
he's so surprised by it. But, like, I like that the movie kind of sees it through and says, like, no, we're not judging this. See where it goes, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's only fair to
uh-huh.
sort of...
Yeah. And, I mean, it's also a small little revolution subject matter. I mean... Transgenders are hot.
Oh yeah.
They have the best, I mean, I think so. Like
yeah.
They have the best of both worlds, and sometimes they want to make a decision to fully commit to one
right.
or the other. But I think that it's hot to own two major aspects of a sexual
yeah.
gender. And I mean, one of my favorite shows right now is called Hit or Miss with Chloe Sevigny, and it's about a transgender hit man, woman, however you want to see it, who's getting all this money doing hit work, like
right.
killing people
right.
in order to fund her operation.
Right, right.
But like how her sexuality is, like, she's very visceral and like aggressive, but then she's so vulnerable. And like it's so beautiful because she's going through all these hormonal changes, but she still has that equipment.
Yeah.
It's like, I just think it's so hot. So Eugene is seeing that too. And it's like, I mean, there, you don't see too much of that. What's the name of that movie with Cillian Murphy that was fairly recent? It's like, was it Breakfast at Pluto?
Breakfast,
similar
yeah.
idea.
Yeah.
I mean, drag is sexy. It's
yeah.
it's teetering the line of like what's okay and what's not. And I mean, I went to see the show, the film strip, a picture show, a go-go, at the Admiral Theater, and Peaches Price, like, got, like, a crowd of men who had just been seeing, like, women's strip completely full Monty, and, like, completely titillated by that, like, had just mesmerized the audience on the edge of titillation and curiosity.
Yeah, I'm seeing it tonight, and I'm so excited. I mean, in a society that attempts to so rigidly define the roles
yeah.
of the male and female persona, to take on the transgendered way of life, my God, how brave and exciting and new. And I mean, I applaud I applaud the writers. I applaud, you know, Clay for willing to go there with his being willing to go there with his character. I mean, I love the questions that this film poses, and I hope that we see more cinema that and art that does that, because there are so many powerful people that are doing so many innovative things that we don't even put in media and draw attention to. We really should.
Yeah. Okay, I'll ask you guys this, and then I'll let you go, because I don't want to take up too much of your time. But
it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it has. This is a really good one. I like this one.
What can we all expect from Volume 2?
Volume 2, I have, with the editor, so I feel like I'm okay with saying this, I have titled Tromorganic Strikes Back.
Ah.
And so, you know, it's going to be a lot more gore, a lot more mayhem, lasers, boobs.
Oh yeah, you would see
Prince Albert's epic deaths, discoveries,
emotional moments,
like connections that are deep, newfound roles in your life, whether it be like with someone you love or someone you never knew existed. And it's basically like the perfect way to seal off this event film reboot, which is to like bring everything that you wondered about the first one that probably you didn't even think you would ever answer, but legitimize and make into an epic.
Yeah, I mean, you especially on the effects side, the things you were going to see in this film, the practical effects, which are so limited now in the world of CGI,
it's
so incredibly impressive. That's exciting. You see a lot more with the laser, which is very exciting. The characters really develop. It gets intense, and we're really not lying when we say you have seen nothing yet. You think that this film is exciting and epic? Wait. This really is our Empire Strikes Back.
And you'll see, like, certain characters who, in contrast to some who may have compromised and gotten soured, or just, you know, happen to be standing in the line of fire, maybe get a chance to be rewarded for staying true to themselves. And, you know, maybe a happy ending that they weren't quite planning on, but what the hell?
A happy ending nonetheless. Nobody's perfect.
And
on the publicity relations answer to that would be, there's a lot of fantastic cameos.
Oh, good.
Oh, yeah.
There are scenes shot from all over the world in places that are legally, technically, I mean, like in certain parts of Asia that never should have happened had Troma not been involved the way they were. Basically, the world is involved in Volume 2, and the social issues come to a head, and we got to film some of this in France.
Yeah, that was so exciting. So really,
and an epic dance number.
Yes! Oh my god, the epic dance number!
So I just say, like, pull out the popcorn and get ready for this one.
If we could ask you for anything, it's that you ask your local theaters and local festivals to screen Nukem High Volume 1 and get the word out there, because Volume 2 is going to be that much bigger and that much better.
Well, I certainly hope it comes back to Chicago, and I certainly hope you guys come.
If you will have us, we will be back.
Yep. I wish it were up to me.
Well, it's up to you.
All right. Okay. I'm going to
start the revolution.
I'm going to start. Listen, thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
So there's the show. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope the sound of blenders preparing frozen coffee drinks was not too distracting. Thank you again to Asta Paredes, to Clay Von Karlowitz, and to Catherine Corcoran, who were terrific guests who do a great job in the movie. Please see Return to Nukem High Volume 1. It's a ton of fun if you're a Troma fan or just a fan of outrageous horror, comedy, B-movie kinds of things. You should follow them all on Twitter. Follow Asta Paredes at, she's at TulipNoir87. Follow Clay Von Karlowitz at ClayVon87. And follow Catherine Corcoran. She's at Cather, C-A-T-H-E-R, Corcoran, C-O-R-C-O-R-A-N. Follow all three of them. They are terrific people, and I wish them the best of luck in the future. Please request screenings of Return to Nukem High Volume 1 in your theater. Please request screenings of Volume 2, because I want it to come to Chicago and we can do all this again. Continue to support Troma. Continue to support independent film. Continue to support these three actors. Continue to support F This Movie. Continue to support me, everyone. Please, continue to support me. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.